when I was at the White House picnic, people have probably seen that clip. I was on the phone. I got to spend 10 weeks in a federal prison.
They love to throw the book at you when you're on the wrong side of the political aisle.
I said, I'm endorsing Donald J. Trump for president.
Trump picked up his first endorsement from a sitting member of Congress, and it came from Clarence Congressman Chris Collins.
I didn't know I was the first one. All of a sudden, every news station is calling. He named me to be the congressional liaison to the White House for his first term. Meetings in the Roosevelt Room and the Oval Office, flew with him on Air Force One. I was on the inside of the inside of Trump world for his first term. When the Access Hollywood tapes, all of his supporters deserted him, and I was the only one still standing. They wanted the congressman to go to jail. After 70 years of creating jobs and serving the country and a six-minute phone call, no one could have anticipated or did that the stock would be trading off-market. NASDAQ would not honor the trading halt. They didn't care if I died in jail or not. I was persecuted, prosecuted, railroaded, and coerced with my son as leverage to get me. And they did. The judge came down on me like a ton of bricks, sentenced me to 26 months. 3 weeks after I was pardoned, COVID hit that prison camp. 100% of the folks in the Pensacola prison camp contracted COVID.
Wow.
With no treatment. I would have, at age 70 with asthma, I would have had COVID.
You were a high-risk patient.
The judge and the U.S. attorney were gambling with my life and didn't care.
A former Western New York Congressman Chris Collins is among more than a dozen people pardoned by President Trump.
President Trump likely saved my life.
Now in 2025, he's staging a political comeback in Florida's 19th district.
I've got my energy back. I intend to live to be 100. I got 25 years to go.
Down the rabbit hole. Down. Cypherpunk. Rabbit.
Welcome to Cypherpunk, where we explore money's history, crypto's future, and Web3's role in advancing human rights, freedom, and digital liberty. Today's guest is Chris Collins, former U.S. Congressman from New York, early Trump ally, a man who's lived through business, politics, scandal, prison, and a presidential pardon. Now in 2025, he's staging a political comeback in Florida's 19th district. We're here to talk about his remarkable stories, the flaws in our current system, and what the future of freedom might look like. Chris, thanks for coming on.
Matt, thank you for inviting me. As I think I said, this is the first podcast I've ever been involved with. So
I'm glad to take your podcast virginity here. First one. Here we go. So many interesting stories you probably have. I'd love to just, you know, why don't you tell us about yourself, your life? You know, I saw that you're an electrical engineer. Is that correct? Or mechanical engineer?
Mechanical.
I need a mechanical engineer for some of my projects. So are you still practicing at all?
I don't charge.
Oh, that's even better. That's even better. So you do like airflow and all sorts of stuff in like, you know, server rooms and that kind of stuff?
No, when I was an engineer?
Yeah, when you were practicing.
No, I was a mechanical engineer selling electric motors and gearboxes.
Ah, okay, gotcha.
For power plants and big industry, steel mills, paper mills.
Because I have a data center and they said I need a mechanical engineer for some stuff. So I'd like to do airflow and, you know, how much CFMs and all these different things. So we kind of just did some napkin math and it wasn't the greatest project. So, but tell me about your life and how you got into politics and, you know, unpack. Let's hear about your life, Chris.
Well, that's why I've written a book that's being published on December 16th. It's 30 chapters.
Oh, wow.
And starts when I was born in 1950, before people had televisions, right up until now. So I've had an interesting life for sure. And, you know, I grew up, you know, like I said, 1950. My dad went to work with all the others. Came home, the moms hung out together, the kids played together outside. You know, again, there was no television. And my dad was a engineer with General Electric and moved every 4 to 5 years. So we relocated as a family, went to Schenectady, New York, into New York City.
Schenectady.
Upstate.
That's where my mom's from, upstate.
Upstate, Joel, New York. George, oh, well,
Troy.
Yeah, right on Glens Falls, right on Lake George.
Yep.
Then a stint in North Carolina in the mountains, Hendersonville near Asheville. That's where I went to high school. And then he ended up in New Hampshire for a year and ultimately left General Electric, became president of General Signal Corporation in Rochester, New York. And that's where he then was for 40 years.
I actually just got back from Lake George maybe like 2 weeks ago.
Great part of the country.
It is a great part of the country. Too bad all the communism has kind of ruined it a little bit. High property taxes.
So I went to NC State, got an engineering degree because, again, I went to high school in near Asheville, North Carolina. And then when I graduated, I considered myself a transplanted rebel and went to work for Westinghouse in the Birmingham, Alabama office and got an MBA at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. And was there for 4 or 5 years. And then to move up within the organization, they transferred me to Buffalo, New York to work in their motor and gearing division, making heavy equipment for paper mills, steel mills, power plants. And surprisingly, I was the youngest general manager in their history at age 29. When I was 32, I got the phone call. They were shutting the operation down. Would I like to buy it?
So really?
I'm 32 years old. I don't have any money or anything like that. I did a leverage buyout, borrowed all the money. I was able to put a team together, and we acquired that division I had been running for Westinghouse and had to relocate all the machinery 20 miles north up near Lake Ontario. And I then ran that company for 15 years. And then ultimately got the phone call and sold it. So
you got the phone call. What's that? What does that mean?
That means a private equity group called and said, we want to buy your company.
Oh, wow.
That's the phone call.
That's the phone call. That sounds like a good phone call to get.
It was. And, we did sell it. I stayed with them for a year and I didn't like being an employee again. I'd been the CEO of my own company for 15 years. And that's what kicked off the potential of me going to Congress. 1998, I was recruited to run up in Niagara Falls against a 24-year incumbent who had never had a challenger.
Wow.
So if you go back to 1998, Bill Clinton, his own trials, if you will, we felt like the Republicans would win 40 seats in Congress that year. I put together a great team. I was neck and neck with 4 weeks to go in the election. And that's when Newt Gingrich decided to impeach Bill Clinton. It changed the entire map. So this is one of those midterm elections when normally the party that's not in power picks up as many as 40 seats.
Yeah.
The Republicans, it was the first time in like decades, the Republicans actually lost 5 seats.
Wow.
And ultimately I did not win.
Wow.
So it was an experience and I chalked that up. It's a chapter in my book. I then went and became a serial entrepreneur and acquired 20 different businesses over the next 10 years. And at some point I was recruited to become the county executive of Western New York, Buffalo, Erie County. Millions residents, $1.5 billion budget, and the county was bankrupt. The demographics were, it was a 2-to-1 Democrat county. City of Buffalo, 300,000 people, 8-to-1 Democrat. And yet I thought my message, private sector guy, the county was bankrupt, I could give a message, elect the chief executive, not a chief politician. I promised to implement Lean Sigma, business efficiency, into a municipal government for the first time in the United States. I said, we're going to have black belts, yellow belts, white belts working for the taxpayers. And people said, well, it sounds like a bunch of ninjas. And I said, you're right, ninjas fighting for the taxpayer. The long and short of it is I won the election. The largest landslide in the history of elections, 63% of the vote.
As a Republican or a Democrat?
As a Republican.
Oh, wow.
In a 2-to-1 Democrat county.
That's pretty impressive.
And I won 43 out of the 44 cities, towns, and villages.
Wow.
The only one I lost was the city of Buffalo, which was 8 to one Democrat. But I did get a substantial vote out of the city. So anyway, I spent 4 years as the county executive, turned everything around, at which point they decided they would go back to their Democrat roots, and I lost my reelection.
That's unbelievable. I mean, so how, first off, how did you even get the message through? Because it feels like in some of those areas, it's just like a foregone conclusion. I mean, nothing you can say or do is going to change anybody's mind. I mean, how did you pull that off?
Well, back in those days, I put up my own money. I had enough success that I funded my own campaign. We ran commercials on the 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 10 o'clock news. We didn't have the internet. We certainly didn't have podcasts. So combination of direct mail and the traditional, 30-second spot on the news channels.
Wow.
That got my message across. And because the county was bankrupt, the parks were closed, the beaches were shut down.
That bad.
The state had taken over the county's finances. When New York State takes over your county's finances.
Yikes.
So the people were open to my background as a business executive, as an engineer.
Yeah.
They didn't care if I was a Republican or Democrat or independent. It didn't matter. So I did. I did win.
That's fantastic.
Succeeded. And then unfortunately, I lost my reelection because of the city of Buffalo. I again won 42 of the 44 cities, towns, and villages, but the 8-1 Democrat advantage in the city of Buffalo cost me the election.
I mean, do you think that in these big blue cities, I mean, like
Buffalo,
do you think that these are actually, they're actually running legitimate elections in these places, or, do you think there's so much fraud?
When I was running in 2011, no, there was no fraud.
No fraud?
No, there was no fraud.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
My old guidance counselor was, he recently passed away, but his name was Neil Curley, and his uncle was the famous, I think it was like James something Curley of Boston way back in the day. And he won his election while he was in jail, but he used to tell me how they used to cheat back in the day, and how all these states, they don't have voter ID. He said that the unions would have, the day off of the election, you don't work those days and they don't check voter ID. So they just basically, he said they would go through the obituaries in the newspaper for the whole couple of years between the elections. And then, they would basically have the union members and say, hey, you're going to this precinct. Here's your name. You go up and you show and you do it. And he said, that's how they, before computers and all this stuff, he's like, that's how it was run. That's how the machine was run in some of these big, big blue cities. So I don't know if that's, obviously now it's much harder to do that, but they got the machines now and, no one's allowed to see the ballots and you got to go to court. And for here we are 8 years later and we can't see what's happening. Nobody can view these ballots in whatever the county is in Georgia.
Well, I don't think for a second anyone cheated for me to lose that election.
Yeah.
But initially the book, which is being published on December 16th, I was going to call it Serendipity, was going to be the title. Something bad happens and it turns out in hindsight, it was something that was good. So me losing that election ended up in the long run being a positive. So that was 2011. I then decided to run against the incumbent Congresswoman, Kathy Hochul. Now Governor Hochul.
Oh, man.
She was the incumbent member of Congress. I put a team together and we ran one hell of a race. It's the only election she ever lost.
Wow.
I won by a couple of thousand votes. They didn't even have the results for almost a week. They were counting absentee ballots and whatever. So in 2012, having lost my re-election in 2011, the next thing you know, I'm going to Congress. So serendipity, the best thing that happened was I lost that election.
I kind of feel that way about Trump's 2020 election.
You're right.
It's the same kind of thing. And now he's come back in 2024 and it's like, oh my God, you were so angry and watch what happened. And a month later, we still don't know who won. And these cities, there's all this shady stuff going on. And then now it's like, oh, thank God he lost that election. Cause you really saw what they did.
Well,
it was unbelievable.
He was ready this go around. Spent 4 years planning to go back, writing hundreds of executive orders, putting together a first-class team. I mean, when he won in 16 and I was his number one supporter, he wasn't prepared like he is as he's now entered his first 100 days.
You can see it, man. It's unbelievable what we've seen so far in the first 100 days. I mean,
In the team he's put together, they're all in lockstep.
Yeah.
And that was not the definition of the team that he put together after he won in 2016. So
it's beautiful to see, because you've got former Democrats and you've got independents, mm-hmm. and you've got, you know, kind of just this ragtag group of this broad tent of different people. And the key is kind of like, you know, working together, loyalty. I mean, that's nice to see, you know, yeah. And competence, right?
So again, serendipity, that was going to be the title of my book. They said, you're selling yourself short. It wasn't just luck. You worked hard. And my first chapter says, the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Ah, I love that quote. That's the damn truth.
So at any rate, you know, that started my congressional career. And the other big moment was when I endorsed now President Trump.
You were the first person to endorse him, weren't you?
First member of Congress. It was February 24th of 2016. And I had been supporting Jeb Bush.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Jeb Bush. Mm-hmm. But as Trump tagged him, low energy Jeb.
Low energy Jeb, whatever his name.
Unfortunately, he was not a good candidate.
Yeah.
And after the South Carolina primary, he withdrew. Because I'm not somebody who's supporting Jeb Bush and I'm going to leave him on the street corner.
Yeah.
But when he withdrew, I had to decide, all right, who am I now going to support? And when I looked at who was left, you know, a business guy named Donald J. Trump was an obvious choice for me as a business guy who was elected county executive. Mm-hmm. My slogan was elect a chief executive, not a chief politician. Mm-hmm. That certainly applied. So on February 24th that morning, I said, I'm endorsing Donald J. Trump for president. I didn't know I was the first one. I just didn't know. All of a sudden, every news station is calling, you know, Congressman Collins is the first member of Congress to endorse Donald J. Trump for president. Jeff Sessions was the second, but he came out of the Senate. I was even before him.
You know, Trump doesn't forget these things, that's for sure.
Loyalty means a lot.
It means something in this world, in this life, you know?
So, you know, the sidebar on that was I'd been in Congress 3 years and had never been on a TV show. I'd never been on CNN, on MSNBC, on Fox Business. And I'd said to my communications director, do you think you could get me interviewed two times this year? In the next 12 months, find some issue somewhere where I could be invited onto one of these shows and get interviewed. That's your challenge for the year. Well, the day I endorsed Donald J. Trump, I was on six. I was interviewed six times that day. And from that point on, for the rest of 2016, it was every other day. When I was in D.C. 3 days, I was on Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, on all of them, defending and promoting Donald J. Trump for president.
Wow.
And he asked me to second his nomination at the convention in July in Cleveland. So in front of millions of people on television, that was quite a 3-minute segment for me. I just continued to be his number one supporter. And then, as we know, when the Access Hollywood tapes dropped on October 7th, 2016, less than 4 weeks from the election, and those were Donald J. Trump's words.
Grab her by the pussy. Is that that one?
Well, saying things you might say on the golf course with your buddies that were on tape.
Mm-hmm.
And so that hit the airwaves on October 7th. At that point, Paul Ryan, who wanted to be speaker, basically put a knife in his back. All of his supporters deserted him, said we should allow Mike Pence to become the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I was the first one to endorse him, and I was the only one still standing on October 8th. And I was on all the newscasts defending the president. He subsequently told me he was watching me on TV and cringing a little bit. I mean, obviously, but I would say these were words.
Yeah. We've all said and done things we're not proud of.
I said, let's compare it to
actions.
Let's compare it to Bill Clinton's actions and Hillary Clinton, you know, defending her husband. So I said, you know, but again, I was one of the few that thought he could still win and continue to support him for the next 4 weeks. And he won.
I know he did. Yes, he did. That was his interesting times, you know.
So I was his first phone call after he thanked me for all of my past support. And subsequently, he named me to be the congressional liaison to the White House for his first term. Mm-hmm. I was on his executive committee, meetings in the Roosevelt Room, in the Oval Office, flew with him on Air Force One. I was on the inside of the inside mm-hmm. of Trump world for his first term.
Oh, wow. What, you got any cool stories you want to share with us that you can tell us now? It's been eight years later or whatever.
Well, they're in my book.
Give us a little sneak preview. You know, when you're finished with your book, one of my favorite things to do is sit down with authors. And I've had a lot of authors come through here and we do like a book series on the book. So after I read the book, I'll have additional questions. And then it kind of is a cool thing we can do. So I'm really excited to now read your book and then maybe sit down and do a couple more episodes about your book.
Well, there are a lot of stories. Whenever we were in a meeting in the Roosevelt Room, mm-hmm. and there's many cases, 20 people, I mean, it's a large meeting room in the White House. President Trump always insisted I sit directly to his left. And, you know, that's how close I was. People would say, could you get his autograph for me? And I went, okay, I can probably do that. So at one point I had $100 bills. And I got six of them and I taped them to the back of a manila folder. I had two folders, three on each one. And I'll remember the meeting. And so imagine I'm sitting next to the President of the United States during the meeting. And I take my elbow and I'm elbowing him on the side to get his attention. He looks over. Chris, what is it? I said, Mr. President, can I get your autograph? He said, oh, sure. So I put these two in front of the President of the United States, these $100 bills, and he's signing them with a Sharpie.
Nice.
And subsequently to my very special friends, I framed those.
That's pretty cool.
With a thing on the back that attested to the fact I witnessed the President of the United States autographing these. These are the real deal. But there was a fun story. Most people would say you elbowed the President of the United States. I said I had to get his attention. I wanted his autograph. He is a down to earth, real person. In meetings, he's a listener. He listens, and then makes a decision. And when he makes a decision, you better rock and roll. And that's the path you're going to take. But people don't realize he is a quiet listener in the meetings until he makes his decision. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't control these meetings. In most cases, he's
absorbing the different
absorbing sides. Yeah, the information.
This. Yeah, I've heard and seen this. I'm a big fan of the All In podcast guys, and they've most of the All In podcast guys kind of saw what was happening the previous 4 years, and they kind of rallied behind Trump at the very end there and kind of helped push his message out. And they met with him in person, and they said, you know, hey, what they're showing you on TV is not the damn truth. They're saying about everything. You know, this guy's very thoughtful. He's much more intelligent than you give him credit for.
Yep. I was witness of that all the time.
Interesting. Interesting. I like that. It's an interesting strategy to kind of hear. You want to absorb the different viewpoints and opinions and thoughts. And then, you know, you kind of gather all those things and make a decision.
Well, that's why he is so successful in the private sector. Mm-hmm. You know, gather your information, process it, make a decision and move on.
Yeah. Okay. That's really, really interesting. It kind of reminds me of, you ever hear the story about Abraham Lincoln, about how he would kind of talk to different people and have these kind of debates and discussions. And, you know, sometimes I think one story of him was like everybody in the room at one point had said to do one thing. And then he's like, he decided to still do the other thing, but it is an interesting story. Very interesting story. But yeah, I mean, sometimes you process all this information and take it into account and make the decision. Right.
Yeah.
And I think most presidents are used to just being told what to think. And we've seen that for so long that there's the think tanks and the opinions and this, and, you know, here's the advice and you adopt these positions and you do this. And, you know, that decision gets outsourced to this guy. And I think we've seen a lot of that in Trump. What Trump has really done is he's totally upended that in a lot of ways, like, you know, completely upended that.
He is the president.
There you go.
And period.
That's how it should be.
That's how it should be.
He is the chief executive officer of the United States. I mean, he's the chief of the executive branch. I mean, that's what it is. And that's, you know, I don't think we've seen that for the past 30, 40 years, even really. I think maybe the last person I can think of that was similar to that might've been like maybe Ronald Reagan.
Right.
Kind of, you know.
Kind of.
Yeah. So, you know, we're really witnessing something beautiful that we haven't seen in a lifetime, right? The the administrative state that's kind of been creative, that he's kind of dismantling a little bit of that and taking the executive power, as he rightly should, because we elect the only person that's really answerable to the people is the, you know, the executive branch, because every 4 years that person is elected by the people. So it is definitely an interesting thing. What do you, obviously there's the mainstream narrative of the story that you were arrested for insider trading. Do you want to set the record straight on that? Tell me what your,
sure.
what your thoughts are, what exactly happened, why you think it happened, you know, what, lay it all out for me.
Well, if I was one of the main investors in a company in Australia, the company was a public company at that time, mm-hmm. Raising money on the Australian stock market, not listed in the U.S.,
uh-huh.
not raising money in the U.S. And we had a drug to treat secondary progressive multiple sclerosis, devastating disease, 75% women who've had multiple sclerosis from maybe their teenage years, but by the time they're in their mid to late 50s, mm-hmm. the treatments stop working. And it goes into what they call secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. There's no treatment. They end up in a wheelchair. They lose mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, suicide is very prevalent with that particular group of women.
Mm-hmm.
We had a unique way to treat that, to not so much cure someone, but give them back their mental capacity
mm-hmm.
To reengage with their families. You know, we had people on a compassionate basis, since there was no treatment. Under a doctor's care, a patient would take our drug, and we were getting letters from family members saying, "You've given me back my mom."
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's still in a wheelchair, but she's got her mental facilities back.
Mm-hmm.
That was our drug. We knew it worked because we had patients using it on a compassionate basis. The problem was the FDA required for us to get it approved in the U.S. We needed to run a full trial with people on the drug and then placebo, people not on the drug. And one of the requirements was a walking test. How long does it take you to walk across the room? If you're in a wheelchair, you can't walk across the room.
Yeah.
And our drug was targeting the very late stage patients,
mm-hmm.
wheelchair. We had to go back and put patients in it that were midway
because
mm-hmm. they could walk. Uh-huh. Well, it turns out the long and short of it is because of the walking test and the way that disease progresses, the FDA said we don't see a compelling enough difference
mm-hmm.
between the patients on the drug and the patients on the placebo. So we will not approve your drug. It was a devastating day.
Mm-hmm.
I got that information when I was at the White House picnic. People have probably seen that clip. I was on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I called my wife and I called my son.
What is the clip exactly?
It shows me on the telephone.
Uh-huh. Paul, can you pull up the clip? Let's take a look at it. So let me, like, my first question is, drug was more of a mental health thing, kind of like a depressant or something, or?
No. It was a stimulant to re-engage your brain.
Okay.
Where the people were in a fog, they didn't know what day of the week it was and so forth. So, it was a stimulant to basically re-engage your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So
it wasn't meant to really treat the underlying multiple sclerosis. It was more just a mental kind of thing.
It was to bring a late stage patient who's in a total fog,
mm-hmm.
doesn't know what
miserable,
day,
can't move,
miserable and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And it typically, we found it would give them back some minor mobility, but more importantly,
when you say minor mobility, what do you mean?
They could use their arms more.
Okay, they could use their arms. Gotcha.
But the key was the mental piece.
Okay. Gotcha.
They could communicate with their family, talk with their family mm-hmm. at dinner time
mm-hmm.
and so forth. So it was not going to have them running a marathon.
There wasn't a miracle cure is what you're getting at.
But for a late stage patient, and again, suicide.
Quality of life, giving
quality of life,
life. Okay.
And suicide mm-hmm. was prevalent in that particular population.
So they do this with a lot of, you know, pain patients. They give them morphine and different things to at least make them comfortable, so they're, you know, not miserable.
Well, ours would actually let them re-engage with their yeah. families.
Okay.
But anyway, the FDA said, we're not going to approve it.
Mm-hmm.
I got an email when I was at the White House picnic and I read the email.
Okay.
Based on what we saw with our compassionate patients, mm-hmm. we knew it worked.
Yeah.
There was no doubt.
There was no doubt, yeah.
But again, we got the notice that it failed. That's the end of the company. Mm-hmm. There was a trading halt on the stock in Australia, which is where it was traded. Mm-hmm. A U.S. citizen can't even, I had my stock, my family stock was mm-hmm. in Australia. As a U.S. citizen, you're not even allowed to trade it mm-hmm. in Australia. But we put a trading halt instantly when mm-hmm. the results came out. Every member of the board shared the results with their families. Mm-hmm. You couldn't sell the stock. What's the harm? Mm-hmm. And certainly no one ever suggested I ever sold any stock. But what I didn't know is my son had moved his stock to the U.S. 2 weeks prior.
What does that mean, moved his stock to the U.S.?
He took it out of the Australian market and placed it with a brokerage house in the United States, even though it wasn't listed in the United States.
How is that even possible?
Under NASDAQ. They will trade thinly traded stocks like this and what they call the pink sheets mm-hmm. off market.
Okay.
And that he moved his stock into the U.S., put it in a brokerage account, and minor amounts of that stock were traded in the U.S., again, off market on what they call the pink sheets. Mm-hmm. NASDAQ did not honor our trading halt. Mm. The chairman of the board sent a letter, you know, to in my support when I was, you know, in the middle of the legal issues, saying every member of the board shared the results. It was a trading halt. No one could have anticipated or did that the stock would be trading off market. NASDAQ would not honor the trading halt. So when I called my wife and I called my son, there was never any thought of somebody trading stock. Mm. How could you? His stock was in Australia and there was a trading halt. I didn't know he had moved it. Mm. I also didn't know that his wife and his future father-in-law, his fiance and future father, had purchased some stock off market over the last few weeks or months, mm-hmm. you know, few shares here and there on the pink sheets. So I told my son, you know, I'm sorry to tell you, the stock is not being approved. We've lost our investment. Worse, the women that we've been mm-hmm. treating are no longer going to be able to use this.
Why could they still not use it though?
Because we weren't allowed to make it any longer.
Even though it was made, was it not made in the U.S. though? Was it made
no,
in Australia?
Australia.
So why?
And well, we couldn't sell it.
You mean you couldn't sell it into the U.S. market?
Or, well,
you could sell it anywhere else or?
Well, no, we were looking to get U.S. approval. Mm. So at any rate, that was the end of the company.
Isn't there something now that's called like compassionate use or something like that?
That's what we were doing.
Okay.
Looking to get it approved in the U.S. so we could sell
it. So even to have the compassionate use thing, you still have to get it some level of approval.
Right. Mm. So at any rate,
so this is the video apparently, I guess.
Did you want to react to it now or not yet?
I don't. Oh, there I am.
Spoke for 6 minutes.
Yeah, that was my 6-minute phone call to my wife and my son. And I did share the results with them. Not thinking that they would trade stock on it, because again, I thought the NASDAQ would honor the trading halt, which they didn't. Mm-hmm. So the next morning at 9:45, I get a call from my son who says, Dad, the stock is being traded on the pink sheets, mm-hmm. and I sold some of my stock. Mm-hmm. I said, well, your stock's in Australia. He said, I just moved it to the U.S. 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And then he said, my fiance and her dad also sold stock. I said, I didn't even know they owned stock. Mm-hmm. They bought a few shares on NASDAQ. And I said, well, we can't undo something that you shouldn't have done, mm-hmm. but we're never talking about this again. Mm-hmm. And that was that. Well, his name and his fiance's name and her dad's name popped up as they saw a lot of trading going on because mm-hmm. The results came out and people knew that the drug was not being approved. And they didn't know the results at the time. They knew there was a trading halt in Australia and the results were out and people were guessing. Was it good news or bad news? They didn't know.
Why would there be a trading halt if it was good news?
Well, we put a trading halt in place the minute the results came out until we were able to release the results. Mm. We were trying to digest exactly what the FDA said. Mm-hmm. What was their rationale? Did it make any sense? And so we put a trading halt on the stock.
is there, so after that happened, there's really no path forward? I mean, because I heard like people buy some of these drugs after and they retry them for different trials and all that kind of stuff.
In this case, it was such a unique application. No, that was the end of the company.
Gotcha. Okay.
So at any rate, 9 months later, I got the proverbial knock on the door. The U.S. attorney in New York City, Southern District, was big game hunting. Mm-hmm. They tied my name to it, even though no one ever said, I never sold stock.
Mm-hmm.
It was, they guessed mm-hmm. that I had called my son.
Mm-hmm.
They had no proof of any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he did sell stock,
mm-hmm.
24 years old. He didn't know better. People do things like that. And at the end, I was the big game they could bring down.
Was he on the board or something?
No.
So essentially he did get the inside information. I mean, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes in my life too, you know, but he did do something he wasn't supposed to do.
Well, and normally in his situation, other than I was his dad, that would have been a settlement with the Security and Exchange Commission,
yeah.
SEC.
Uh-huh.
They would have said, you're going to disgorge your profits and here's a fine.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Okay.
And that's what they did with his fiance.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't go. She wasn't criminally charged.
Mm-hmm.
But they saw a way to link. They went after his future father-in-law mm-hmm. to bring him in. They went after him to get to me, even though I never sold any stock.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing dragged on for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a case against me. The U.S. attorney subsequently wrote a book, and he admitted that.
Mm-hmm.
And they had trampled all over my rights as a member of Congress. They had seized computers from my staff, which mm-hmm. they're not allowed to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was messy. And
who is this? Is this Bragg guy?
Yeah, this is Berman, the U.S. attorney in the Southern District, was sloppy. Mm-hmm. In his book, he admits that they did things they shouldn't have done.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to file an interlocutory appeal
mm-hmm.
to the Supreme Court concerning, you know, my charges. And again, I was never charged with selling stock, but it was conspiracy in sharing the results. But they never had anyone to say I shared the results.
Mm-hmm.
I did, but they never had anyone that would testify mm-hmm. to that. So they didn't have a case against me.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes in his book, we decided to separate the congressman from his son, try his son separately.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an appeal that would have gone to the Supreme Court. And as a member of Congress, the Supreme Court would be required to hear my appeal,
mm-hmm.
delay my case. That would have delayed it 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, he says, we came up with a strategy to separate the congressman from his son and his son's future father-in-law and try them separately
mm-hmm.
in February, you know, 3 months later. And he put in the book, he said, the assistant U.S. attorney, Damian Williams, came up with that strategy saying, Collins will not stay on the sidelines while we try his son separately. And he says, and it worked. He dropped his appeal and agreed to plead guilty to a conspiracy for insider trading. He puts it in his book.
So what? So basically you...
I took the fall.
So you just said essentially, okay, I'll leave my family out of it and you can take me. Is that the crux of what happened?
And my son ended up and his father-in-law with a sentence of probation.
Okay.
They pled guilty to a single conspiracy for insider trading.
Mm-hmm.
They were both given a sentence of probation. The judge came down on me like a ton of bricks, sentenced mm-hmm. me to 26 months.
Wow.
After 70 years of creating jobs and
yeah.
serving the country yeah. and a 6-minute phone call.
Oh, they love to make an example out of people. They love to, you know, throw the book at you when you're on the wrong side of the political aisle. I mean, we've definitely seen a lot of that. That's
as I said, I was persecuted, prosecuted, railroaded, yeah. and coerced with my son as leverage.
Mm-hmm.
They did the same thing to General Flynn.
Yeah, I saw that.
So that's a chapter in my book.
Yeah, they went after, I think, was it Peter Navarro as well? He was another one who took a fall.
Well, and Paul Manafort.
Guys, they really just, I mean, it's almost like some third world type of stuff that they did, you know, that's what I've been witnessing.
That's why I refer to them as the Department of Injustice.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, it was really bad. Thank God Trump is in power now and is able to clean house there. And it's the stuff they got away with. I mean, the level of corruption, I mean, it's hard for people to even fathom what's been really happening behind the scenes, you know. And, you know, obviously trading stock after you find out that news. And, you know, your son's definitely wrong. I mean, he's definitely in the wrong.
There's no
question about that.
But as a 24-year-old who was not in the business, it's the only time he should have.
Yeah. We all make mistakes.
Disgorged the profit, paid a fine, and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. That's what they charged his fiance with. Mm-hmm. And that was that.
Gotcha.
But I was the big game.
You're the big game, yeah.
And they're correct. They leveraged him to get me, and they did.
And in, it's like, it's crazy in some of these places where they try to bring these cases, like DC, where it's like 98% Democrat, and the Southern District of New York, 95% Democrat. I mean, it's like, you know, how can you actually have a jury of your, how can you actually have a fair trial in some of these places? I mean, it's like impossible, right? It's like that Bragg guy, I think was he changing law? I mean, what did they do? Didn't they like change the law and the statute of limitations to try to go after Trump and do some of this stuff? I mean, you can't even make some of this stuff up. I mean, it's so absurd. But I think it actually backfired in their face. For a lot of it, I mean, the American people saw exactly what was going on, and they knew it was phony bullshit, and that's why Trump, you know, increased his vote counts everywhere, won the popular vote, won all the swing states. I mean, it was, you know, it's crazy too, because you'd think they'd learn, because you experienced the whole thing with Bill Clinton when you mentioned that. I mean, when they tried to go after him for what he did, I mean, obviously it was kind of a moral failing type of issue, but you know, a lot of people, you know, people seem to. Be attracted to people when they know that, okay, this guy has flaws, and like you can see they're actually a real person, right? It's not like, oh, there's this guy, you know, like this illusion of like, oh, I'm the, you know, I never make a mistake, I never do anything wrong. And I think that's what Trump's appeal is like, hey, the guy's made mistakes, the guy's, you know, had, you know, failed relationships, the guy's he's a human, right? Like, right. He says things off script sometimes that maybe aren't politically correct. I mean, I think people are attracted to that. And I think that's probably the lesson that, you know, one of Newt Gingrich's, probably one of his big failings was trying to impeach Bill Clinton during that time. Because that, I think, did swing people. People don't like that. People, it's like, why are you wasting? I mean, yes, what Trump said was wrong, right? You know, but he thought he was with the boys, locker room talk. What Bill Clinton did was obviously wrong. But like, why are the taxpayers now paying, you know, millions of dollars to try to prosecute and do, it's like such a waste of taxpayer resources to do this. Like, listen, he's been exposed. We all know what happened. He has to eat crow on that. Like, he is shamed publicly. Like, move on, right? Like, this is just part of being a human. People make mistakes, right? So I think if people largely, that's a, when you try to impeach the president and do these things, I mean, you better be damn sure that there's legitimate evidence and legitimate reason, the treasonous activity or something, to try to do that, or else it's just going to totally fail, backflop in your face. And I think that's what we saw with what they tried to do to Trump. I mean, you know, even they tried to impeach him, but even after he left office, I mean, all of these phony trials and bullshit they tried to pull in these super Democrat areas, I mean, so obviously ridiculously partisan. I mean, why do you think they even tried to do that? I mean, they had to have known. I mean, do you really think they're just so stupid they just didn't think that this would blow up in their face? I mean, what are your thoughts there?
Well, I mean, that's the definition of lawfare. And who they went after and how they did it and where they did it. They got me, you know, did I sell stock? No. When I made the phone call, did I think anyone was going to sell stock? No, there was a trading halt on the stock. That didn't matter to them. Mm-hmm. And they came and got me, and they did leverage my son. And I'm very glad that I did what I did. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he ended up pleading to one felony and got probation. Mm-hmm. And he's moved on with his life.
Yeah.
Everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And so I got to spend 10 weeks in a federal prison camp.
How was that?
That's another chapter of my book. Oh, wait till you read it.
Give me a little preview, because we'll unpack it later. Just a little preview.
All right. Here was the worst piece. This was COVID. Mm-hmm. So this was 2020. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they kept delaying me reporting because there was no treatment for COVID. You're not going to put a 70-year-old in prison. I had asthma. Mm-hmm. You're not going to put a 70-year-old with asthma in prison when COVID, with the guards coming and going. So they kept delaying my report date. And so then it came down to October 13th, every 2 months. And my attorney said, all right, it's a deadly disease. There's no treatments. Collins is 70 years old with asthma. Let's push it till December. It was always 2 months. There was a rumor I might be on a list for a pardon. The judge and the prosecutor all of a sudden, in the face of COVID, said, we're sending him in. We're putting him in October 13th of 2020. There's no treatments for COVID. Mm-hmm. they were all saying you don't put someone like that into that environment. Mm-hmm. The thought that everything they did would go, I'd end up with a pardon and they would have gotten nothing. Mm-hmm. So they made me report, and they had said, hey, it's a camp. You know, it's open. There's, you know, recreation. There's mm-hmm. a library. There's this and that. Well, it was all a hoax. It was all shut down. There was no recreation. There was no library. There was no computers. You could make 1 5-minute phone call a week.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So that's where I thought I was going to this camp in Pensacola. When I get there, they said, no, we have no quarantine facility. We take people like me to the medium security real prison with cells and barbed wire and guards with guns. We're transferring you to Marianna, the federal prison in Marianna, for your quarantine, which ended up being 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And the way they put us was called the SHU, the special housing unit for these real criminals who were misbehaving in this federal prison.
Oh, man.
Got locked in the SHU, which was a cell with a bunk bed and a little slot in the door. That's where I spent my first 3 weeks.
Wow.
They just put a meal through the slot in the
door. What did you do in there?
Nothing. You could read a book. If they had a book, when they came through, they said, we don't have any books. We've given them all out. Here's a Bible.
Oh, man.
I had a Bible. Well, that's all right. I got to read the Bible. Mm. But like 3 days a week, you could take a shower. You'd have to back up to the cell door, put your hands through the slot. They would handcuff them. You'd step back. They'd open the door. You'd go to the shower down the end of the hall. Uh-huh. You'd reverse that. You'd take your quick shower three times a week.
Wow. Did you shower with handcuffs on? Or did
no,
you-
no. They would take them off, the and then you would reverse all that. You could shave three times a week. They put a single-use razor through the slot, and then they'd come back an hour later and pick them back up again.
Wow.
But yeah, so my first 3 weeks was in a real prison in a orange jumpsuit, taking three showers a week in a room where, you know, if I had a book, I could read a book. And it was 3 weeks of hell. But then they moved me back to the Pensacola camp, where I then spent 7 weeks in food service, helping prepare food, but there was nothing to do. Mm-hmm. We were in our dorm. No one wore masks. The guards didn't wear them. And
welcome to Florida. We didn't play that game for the most part.
So I was pardoned. I got out, came back, you know, to Marco Island.
So you were pardoned before Trump left office in his first term?
Yes. Okay. December 22nd. So he had lost his reelection. Mm. But I was pardoned the same day he pardoned Roger Stone, General Flynn, Paul Manafort, you know, a lot of his supporters, where they came after them with the whole lawfare piece.
How did they do all this when he was still in office? That's kind of what I'm wondering. Like, how do they still come after all of his guys? I mean, what do you think about that? Because now it's like he has full control over everything, it seems like. He's really consolidated control.
Yeah, his first term was very different than what you're seeing now. So at any rate, you know, I was pardoned. That was pretty emotional. Mm. 3 weeks after I was pardoned, COVID hit that prison camp. 100% of the folks in the Pensacola prison camp contracted COVID.
Wow.
With no treatment. Mm. I would have, at age 70 with asthma, I would have had COVID.
You're a high-risk patient. I mean, you're 65 and above with, you know, preconditions, comorbidities or whatever. I mean, yeah, you were.
And they were saying from day one, you don't take someone like that and put him in that environment.
Yeah.
But they wanted to make sure I did, quote, time. Mm. And I've said President Trump likely saved my life.
It's possible, yeah.
And the judge and the U.S. attorney were gambling with my life and didn't care.
Yeah.
So I've said, when they are standing at the pearly gates and St. Peter comes down and they're looking for forgiveness, I said, I'm not thinking they will be forgiven. for what they did to me. We will see.
We'll see. I mean, I don't think they were that malicious, but who knows?
No, they were. They knew they should not have put me in. Their own guidelines were, you don't put somebody at age 70 with asthma in the middle of COVID with no treatments.
So they violate, I mean, because you don't have any previous record of anything, right?
No,
I mean,
this of course is like not.
You should just house arrest or, you know, probation or something, you know, first time offense.
They violated the internal guidelines to make sure I went in. They were afraid.
Make an example. And who were these people? Who exactly were the
federal judge, Vernon Broderick.
Broderick.
And the U.S. attorney, Jeffrey Berman.
Jeffrey Berman, okay.
And the assistant U.S. attorney, Damian Williams. The three of them, they just wanted to make sure, because again, they thought I might get pardoned. And everything they would have done for naught. My son got probation. His future father-in-law got probation. And if I was sentenced and then pardoned, what did they accomplish by spending millions and millions and millions of dollars? They wanted the congressman to go to jail. They didn't care if I died in jail or not.
This whole issue has become a big talking point lately, especially with looking at Nancy Pelosi, for example, and her stock portfolio. I mean, like, you know, she's beating Warren Buffett and every hedge fund on Wall Street. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable. It was almost like Hillary Clinton's corn futures trading back in the day. I mean, pretty impressive. So when she gets out of Congress, I mean, you know, she could be a hedge fund manager with this stellar track record. There's a lot of talk about this whole idea. What do you think about this idea that Congress should be banned from trading stocks altogether?
I've heard
a lot of things on both sides.
No, I agree with that. If you're a member of Congress, you should have your money in a mutual fund.
Yeah.
There's no reason to be trading individual stocks. I would say a member and their spouse should not be allowed to trade individual stocks. Put it in a mutual fund like the rest of America. I would support that.
Yeah. What do you think about, I mean, obviously this whole issue is with your son and his, you know, family members, like father-in-law or whatever. How does that extend to that then too? I mean, how do you handle that? How does that even, you know, how do you think about that when we talk about policy about this issue?
Well, members of Congress should not be allowed to own individual stocks nor their spouse. But at some point you really can't go further than that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we all have our own freedoms. So
true.
Somebody true. Who's not an elected official, whether it's your cousin or your uncle or whatever, you can only go so far. And I think in most cases, the complaint has been the members themselves, like a Nancy Pelosi and the spouse. So
Paul Pelosi,
you know, I would support that fully.
I think they're talking about it now. I like the idea of, like, you know, what I've heard also is, like, because crypto, for example, is obviously where, you know, that's one of my main focuses, decentralized technology, freedom, you know, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, this idea that the people that are making the policies, like, don't own any crypto. To me, that kind of bothers me in a way. I mean, just because it's like, hey, you don't understand the technology, you've never used it. So it's like this catch 22 where it's like, you know,
well, you just said it all right.
We don't
there.
Want them actively.
They don't understand.
Yeah. I mean, but you gotta own it so you can experience it and I can send a transaction like this and I can have, you know, you have to understand what you're regulating, right? I guess is what I'm getting at. So it's kind of like the same thing with trading stocks is like, you know, where's the happy medium? What actually makes sense? I mean, you know, it was like Tim Walz, like the guy has never owned a stock. Like he's going to be the vice president of the United States and he's never owned a stock. I mean, he has no investment in the capitalism of America. I mean, like that to me is idiotic, you know, same situation here. I mean, what's the fine line? I've been thinking about this a lot lately because you do want the people who are regulating these things to actually understand what the hell's happening and what they're actually regulating. Right. So, I do like the idea of like, hey, maybe you can, you know, set a plan in motion before you go in where you're going to dollar cost average and just have a weekly purchase, or you're going to just, you know, have, you know, buy a mutual fund or a basket of crypto, a basket of cryptocurrencies. If we talk about crypto, you know, so that way it's an automated thing where, you know, you're still experiencing the upside of American capitalism. But at the same time, you're not individually trading off insider information, you know?
Well, I also don't believe 95% of members of Congress are honest people. Mm-hmm. There may be a, two or three bad apples. There's not 400 members of Congress trading on insider information. First of all, they don't have insider information. So we don't also want to overreact to two or three or five individuals.
I think it might be higher than that. I think I saw something the other day where they showed 10 to 20 people that are in some of these closed door committees. And, you know, with this, Palantir getting a defense contract, and all of a sudden, well, you know, this type of stuff is.
I hear you, but there's 435 members of Congress.
Yeah.
And plus a few that aren't voting, so call it, 440 members of Congress. And if there are 10 people who might be doing something, it's not 440.
That's true.
So we can't overreact, but I do believe in saying members of Congress can't own individual stocks, nor can their spouse. Mm. Put your money in a mutual fund.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So hopefully we'll see some positive legislation on that. I think there's been some stuff floated because it is getting a little out of control with some people. You say less, but from what I've seen, it
should be a nonpartisan. This isn't Republican versus Democrat.
For sure.
So I think once that hits the floor, I think you'll actually see some action. Mm. And I think the American public will embrace that.
What are your thoughts on cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, Web3, the next evolution of the internet, artificial intelligence? As a 70-plus-year-old congressman, what do you think about all these things? How are you looking at the future?
All right. So AI is different than Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I don't understand the basis of Bitcoin myself. Mm. So I guess I'm... It's different.
It's
new. It's novel. Mm-hmm. I don't see anything wrong with it. But am I buying Bitcoin? No.
Well, I'm going to try to convince you to buy some to understand the technology and see what you're working with here.
Well, I actually have people that manage my assets.
Okay.
I'm.
You're not even involved anymore,
no,
really?
No, not at all.
Wow, okay. Makes sense. Bitcoin is essentially just a money that governments can't print. It follows a fixed set of rules on the inflation rate and the total supply. And computer networks all over the world allow them and protect the security of this network and allow it to be used permissionlessly by anybody, anywhere on the planet. So for the 3+ billion people on the planet who don't have access to bank accounts, they can now have a wallet, which is essentially a bank account on a 10-year-old smartphone, for example. So it's just a monetary technology that kind of models gold scarcity, but on the internet. So I guess that's my simple explanation for that. But it allows people to protect their purchasing power, their life's energy, their work energy through space and time. So obviously we saw what happened with COVID and the government printed 50% of all the dollars that ever existed in about 1 to 2 years.
Right.
And we saw, the shocker, record inflation. I mean, if you study Austrian economics, as many Bitcoiners do, you'll understand that, all the talking heads on TV, which are wrong about mostly everything, were obviously going to be wrong that there was going to be no inflation. And we're still kind of looking at the tail end of that.
Mm-hmm.
We have plenty of technology that's incredibly deflationary, but printing 50% of the money supply, you better believe prices are going to go up because you didn't just create more value. All you did was steal people's life energy and purchasing power. It's kind of coming to a head right now with the housing situation as people, when the money has been corrupted on some level, people don't hold the money. So the wealthy people, where do they put their money? They put it into assets. Houses and real estate is the number one place people put money to preserve purchasing power. This has second and third order effects on an economy, on a world, on a population. And for the first time, my generation, the millennial generation, is actually worse off than their parents because they can't afford homes. They can't afford things. Well, why did that happen? Why have housing prices gone up so drastically? Well, because the money has been debased. People don't want to just hold money in a savings account, right? They're going to put it into a hard asset. And that main hard asset has been real estate. So naturally we have an unaffordability crisis. That's a second, third, fourth order effect think about. So, Bitcoin is this idea that, hey, you can store your life's energy in something that is not going to be stolen from you slowly, 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 slowly. Because even if you take the 2%, goal inflation rate, if you run 2% inflation out over 10, 20 years, you've lost half your purchasing power.
You've got a big number.
It's compounding. I think it was Benjamin Franklin who said compounding is the eighth wonder of the world. Well, the opposite is putting your money in a savings account because your money is being compounded against you. Right. So I guess that would be my explanation of Bitcoin and why it's important and why people are.
There's no doubt cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, mm-hmm. it's here to stay.
Yeah.
It's here. It's got its own foundation. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. You know, people of my age are probably not going to be investing in cryptocurrency.
You'd be surprised, man. You'd be surprised. We have a lot of people your age that are, you know, come to our Bitcoin meetups locally here, that are engaged, that are, you know, politically like the idea, and that are, you know, buying and owning it, and, you know, trying to, a lot of them are learning how to self-custody it so they can give it to their children and the grandchildren, right. You know, a transfer of wealth there to just kind of protect some of that life energy, that work energy, you know, in a money that can't be debased, right? So
it's here, it's here, and it's real.
You'd be surprised. Yeah. I mean, I think even Trump has watched him politically evolve on this issue as he's understood it more and more and more. And he's realized, and so has his cabinet and the people on his team mm-hmm. have really started to understand these things, right?
Yes, they have.
So hopefully I can continue to orange pill you.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, man. Before we wrap up here, what's your best advice for people, for the future generations, for my generation? And also, why don't you tell us a little bit about your upcoming political candidacy, and, you know, why are you continuing to run for politics? Because politics is a dirty game, as you've experienced. You know, there's a lot in it. But do you enjoy being politically active?
So I've been in politics for 14 years. Mm-hmm. I made my mark in the private sector with over 20 different companies and thousands mm-hmm. of employees. I found it being in the political, certainly being the county executive of the largest upstate county in New York that was bankrupt, and bringing things like Lean Six Sigma, mm-hmm. business efficiency into a government for the first time in the United States, and then going to Congress. And I served on the Energy and Commerce Committee, the number one committee in Congress for policy and the like. I felt like I was serving the country for all the good reasons, mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it. So now when my end came prematurely, the phone call from the White House picnic grounds and so forth, I didn't go out on my terms. I wasn't planning on going out at that point, mm-hmm. but I did. Those were three or four very bad years. No two ways about it. Mm-hmm. So at this point, I've got my energy back, and I've said, I want to go back for Trump's last 2 years of this term, and then hopefully, whether it's J.D. Vance or someone else, the Republicans will take the White House again in 2028. I want to go back and be part of the Trump team, helping, again, make America great again, healthy again, safe again, and so forth and so on. And so I've decided I'm going to run again to replace Byron Donalds. Mm. I am the most qualified candidate, bar none. And I would go right into the inside world of Trump world where I was before. I would hit the ground running on day one. And anyone else, your first year as a congressman, you don't even know where the bathroom is. People can't even find the House floor. It's like, what is it, on the first floor, the second floor? I mean, the learning curve is more than most people think. Well, I was elected for four terms, served on the number one committee, was on the inside of Trump world for his first term. I will bring that to the area, to Collier County and Lee County residents, serving my constituents, serving the district, serving the state of Florida, as well as the country. I'm just ready to go back, whether that's for two or three terms, at which point I will get my reputation back. I intend to live to be 100. I got 25 years to go. Once I get my reputation back as the member of Congress serving Southwest Florida, and when I do decide to leave on my terms, hopefully, whether it's a hospital board or a museum board or the animal shelter, I will be able to serve my community in a board capacity and not be this person lurking in the background. And I would then enjoy the next 20 years. So I'm going back to serve. I'm the most qualified candidate. I will hit the ground running on day one. Everyone else has got a learning curve that I won't have. And I'll serve for a couple, three terms, retire, and enjoy the rest of my life here in Southwest Florida, giving back in another capacity. So that's why I'm running again, and I intend to win.
this has been a fascinating conversation, and I hope we have many more. And I can't wait to read your book when it comes out. And, you know, hopefully we can do a podcast series on your book.
I'd very much enjoy that, Matt.
Chris Collins, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yes. My first podcast.